Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to All About Agatha, the podcast dedicated to reading and ranking every single mystery novel written by the Queen of Crime, Dame Agatha Christie. I am Kemper Donovan, and I have an interview episode for you all. We are going to get to it in one moment. As I am about to discuss with debut author Kitty Murphy, she wrote a lovely and heartwarming and entertaining mystery set in the world of drag queens in Dublin, in Ireland. Now, Kitty and I do not get into politics in our discussion, and I try not to get into politics as much as possible on this podcast because you all are not coming to this podcast for my political opinions. Yes, it creeps in on a fairly regular basis, actually, because politics is a part of life, but I do try not to approach political issues head on. However, lest there be an elephant in the room while you're listening to this conversation, I would like you all to know that it is a happy coincidence for me that I am airing this episode about a mystery set in the world of drag when there is so much happening with this issue here in the United States. Kitty and I actually corresponded many, many, many months ago. These interviews are often as much as 6 months in the making. So I had agreed to read her book long before any of the current laws in the US banning drag performances in various public forums had been enacted or even close to enactment. So I just want to be clear about that is a coincidence, but I want to be equally clear that for me, it is a happy coincidence because I myself am horrified by these laws. One of them has been enacted in Tennessee thus far, and there are others that are in danger of being enacted elsewhere. I do not support them. I think they are an unnecessary and unconstitutional infringement on a key First Amendment right. If you disagree with me about that, that is your right. But I just wanted to get that out there up top because it is not addressed in my conversation with Kitty. And I wanted you all to know about the coincidental nature of the timing of this episode and also about my stance. That being said, let's get started and get to the interview. My guest today is Kitty Murphy, whose debut novel, Death in Heels, came out, pun very much intended, we'll get there, on New Year's Day of this year, which is a fantastic pub date, starting off the year right. Her novel is a traditional murder mystery placed in the rather untraditional setting of a drag queen nightclub in the heart of Dublin called Trash. I should note that Kitty herself identifies as bi/queer. The book follows a woman named Fiona, Fee for short, who is very much not a drag queen, but whose best friend Robin is just getting his stiletto-clad feet wet in the world of drag when one of his fellow queens at Trash, she is named Eve Harrington, but of course, she is found dead outside the club. When the police deem this death an accident, Fee is nowhere near convinced, and she takes it upon herself to do some amateur investigating, much to the horror of almost everyone involved. Matters proceed from there, much as we would expect them to do in a whodunit. Kitty has a second book in the Dublin Drag Mysteries due out in April of this year, which is such a fast turnaround between first and second books. I'm getting whiplash just thinking about it. But that means that this is the perfect time to be talking about her burgeoning mystery series, and I am very excited to do so. Welcome, Kitty.
Thank you so much for having me. This is so exciting.
So first, we have to talk about the title. I do love dwelling on titles on this podcast. Death in Heels is obviously an appropriate title for a book set in the world of drag shows, but I'm also very much hoping that this is a reference to Christiana Brand's Death in High Heels as well. Is it?
It's not. It's not actually. No, I really wanted a title that would go through the series because I want to look at, you know, a number of books here. We're looking at 8 to 10 books in this series, hopefully.
Oh, wow.
So I wanted one to go through. So Death In. So it's strong. It looks out. And it's a little bit camp and a little bit silly. And it nods to the murder mystery, but also it's quite serious aspects too.
Absolutely. Well, I think it kind of serves double duty. Any Christiana Brand fan, I think, is going to, like, their ears will perk up at this title. The funny thing is that I actually haven't read Death in High Heels by Christiana Brand, but I just recently covered Green for Danger on the podcast's Patreon page just recently. Mm-hmm. That's the last episode that I did. That's my Patreon plug for this episode. But a number of patrons were talking about Death in High Heels on it. And I've always just noted it because it is such an unusual and fun title. So for me, that's like it's an added perk. I mean, that's the first thing I thought of when I saw the title of your book. But I love that you're already thinking about the consistency of titles across the series. And 8 to 10 is, wow, that's quite an order there for a mystery series. Is that guaranteed or is it kind of like a wait and see sort of thing?
Yeah. It's very much a wait and see, but they're in my head.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the character arcs in that sort of range. I'm looking at the drag family. I don't want to let go of them. I love writing these characters. I want to keep going. And I want to think of different things that happen with them and for them and be working towards that through the stories.
Well, it's funny because one of the things that some of the patrons on our Patreon page mentioned when they were talking about even Death in High Heels is that there are apparently a lot of, because it's set in the world of fashion, and there are a lot of depictions stuck in their time, actually, as to the gay subculture. There's one character in particular who's referred to quite often as a pansy. And there's some, and even in Green for Danger, that word crops up a bit, and it made me realize, and I could be wrong about this, but I don't think that Agatha Christie ever actually used that word. Or if she did, she certainly used it very, very sparingly, because I can't think of a time when she did.
I can't think of when she used plenty of other words. But
she did. She certainly did.
Yeah.
But this brings me to my first question, which really has to do with setting a murder mystery in a world that doesn't usually get the murder mystery treatment. I think it's really interesting because even in contemporary mysteries like Rian Johnson's feature films, which have come out in the last couple of years, which I love, they very much capture the present day zeitgeist, but we still see them set within these traditional settings, a cast of characters isolated in a physical way. In Glass Onion, they're on an island. In Knives Out, they're on a big country estate. But in your book, not only are we within a subculture that is not often depicted in murder mysteries, but we're in the middle of a great big city. We're in the middle of Dublin, in the heart of it. I mean, there are crowds of people and strangers constantly flitting across the page. And I was thinking about this, and I think that you could make the argument that the characters in Death in Heels are isolated. They're isolated by what they do and who they are. I mean, this is stating the obvious, but the drag world is very much made up of members of the LGBTQ community, so that in a way you get a little bit of the same closed circle effect. Do you think that's fair?
Absolutely. That's very fair. Absolutely. And I really wanted the feel of the mystery feel of being slightly outside the community looking in the way that a sleuth, and whether it's Poirot, whether it's Marple, whether it's any of the great sleuths, being outside the community and looking in means you can see people in a slightly clearer manner, in a slightly different manner than you would do if you were part of them. And Fee, she's a quiet soul. She's not a star. She's not the middle of the party. She's someone who's on the outside looking in. And that's how I would feel. I have friends in the drag community and I love watching drag and I love going to Dublin. I spend a lot of time there, but I'm happily on the outside looking in. And I really wanted to make that point in the mystery series to view the community in a way. And I adore the community and I feel very much part of the community. You know, as you say, I'm bi queer. It's my home too there. But the drag community is the drag community and I'm not part of that.
Right.
I wouldn't pretend to be.
It's very much, I mean, it's just interesting because she's marginalized. She's on the margins of a marginalized community. which is different from what we get with Miss Marple, or certainly with Poirot, where he's on the margins of society writ large, basically. but you get the same effect, as you say. And I think there is so much made of that, that she is on the outside looking in, which makes her the perfect investigator. It makes her the perfect amateur sleuth, because you really do have to have that distance to be able to effectively see and probe what's happening, and to get a picture of the community in a more holistic way than you would have if your way in were Robin, say, who's just entering the drag community and coming into his own or her own. And actually, you know, you also get into that. I mean, you don't shy away, I think, from, I don't even want to say that there are aspects of depicting the community that would be awkward. It's just that there are certain things that I think people have to negotiate and learn when they're talking about the drag community, which they may not be familiar with. In particular, I'm just going to quote from the text here for a second. I loved this little treatise that you gave on how drag names work, which Fiona gives a Garda. Am I pronouncing that correctly? A Garda?
Oh, God. God. Oh, God.
Guard. Okay. It's that is a police officer, right? A guardian of the peace, right? In Ireland. And so she's having a little bit of a contentious conversation with this female police officer who is referring to our initial murder victim here, Eve Harrington, by another name, let's say. And this is what Fee tells her. She was a man who preferred the female pronoun when she was in drag, I said sweetly. If a queen is in drag, she is her drag name and her chosen pronoun. Most go with the female pronoun, although there are some who use the male pronoun. I was being pedantic, but the woman was annoying me. If he was in his boy clothes, he would be Liam. She died in drag. She is Eve. And the issue there being that the police officer kept on making the reference to Liam and not to Eve. I love that, because I think it's tricky, and we see characters stumbling over that or having trouble with it or intentionally being offensive by using a different pronoun from what might be preferred. That too, I think, contributes to the marginalization of this community. And there are a lot of other places within the book where you're quite specific about this culture. So you already kind of answered this question, but it's very obvious to me that you are somewhat familiar with the culture of drag queens. I couldn't help picturing you as Fee as I was reading the book. That is a trap that, you know, readers should not fall into. An author is not a narrator. I'm sure there are parts of you in every single character that exists in this book. But how did you do your research, I guess, for this book? I mean, what was your process there?
I love it when people ask me if Fee is me, when I compare it to other writers who write the most horrific murderers, and they don't ask them, you know. They ask me if I am the fleece-wearing, bumbling woman who gets things wrong. And I just think, yeah, probably in many ways. But no, Fee is, she's much smarter than me, and I think she's much nicer than me in many ways. Research, years and years of being in drag, but as such, I think I can say it's research now rather than a well-spent youth. But I did ask the Dublin drag family, both the kings and queens, been incredibly kind and really, really generous with their time. And I've been peppering them with questions, like even down to sort of, what does eyelash glue smell like? Or the other day I was asking Victoria's Secret if she wears clip-on earrings, because they seemed really big, the earrings she was wearing. She said, no, they're acrylic. And I thought, oh yeah, okay, fair enough, store that one away. So I've been very lucky to have access to be able to ask people and just double check a few things. But really, it's I think for any writer, it's watching, isn't it? It's watching people, and people are the same world over, whether they're in drag or in a suit, or people are people, and they're very interesting.
Yeah. And I think you make reference to Victoria's Secret in your acknowledgement, but that is a drag queen in the Dublin drag community who you are friends with.
I adore her. Well, I mean, she's very kind, and I adore her quietly. I'm a massive fan. She's a very brilliant Dublin drag queen. Yeah.
I love that. And that's a great name, Victoria's Secret.
It is. She's fantastic.
Well, and speaking of names, I have to mention this, but most listeners are probably familiar with the term Wagatha Christie, which is given to good old Colleen Rooney, a so-called wag, wife and girlfriend of a footballer, who laid a trap for another wag she thought might be leaking stories about her to the tabloids. That one is, it really, I've talked about this with other people on the podcast, but it has wreaked such havoc with my Google alerts, because I have Google alerts for Agatha Christie. And every time something happens with that trial or any of those people, the Wagatha Christie thing, it just, it takes up like 3/4 of the Google alerts for that day. And it's like, yeah, I get it, Wagatha Christie. But you go one step further with the nickname that the queens give to Fee eventually, as she refuses to back down into her investigation of Eve's death. And as the story progresses, other deaths too. In traditional murder mystery fashion, we don't limit ourselves here to one death.
Naturally.
Could you share that nickname with us and how you came up with it? Because it made me chuckle every time that I came.
Robin initially names Fee Agatha Christie. Rather unkindly. And it's not very nice, and it is meant to dig, and it's not a word that I would use lightly. I think we have to be really super careful with slurs. And there are many that I might allude to somebody using, but I'm not going to use them. I'm not. Mm-hmm. We have to be very careful, because words can really hurt. Words can get under our skin, and they can do damage. And you know, we know this. Mm-hmm. But this one, I wanted something a little bit fun. And I thought, you know, Fee can grow into it. She can earn her stripes.
Right. I assume that will be used in future books.
I hope so. Yeah. It is so far, yeah. Yeah. And it becomes more of a fun turn. And it's something that Fee struggles with. And that's fine. I mean, one of her points is, as one of the drag queens saw a point, quite often she refers to Fee as the little straight girl. Mm-hmm. She doesn't ask Fee if she's straight. Nobody asks Fee.
Right.
And it's in the second book that Fee has reason to turn around and say, but you never asked me. Right. You assume.
Right. You really tread a fine line, because I think if you're going to accurately portray this community, this is a community that has had assumptions made about them, mm-hmm. and that have had hurtful words hurled at yeah. them, and still do constantly. And, you know, in the best traditions of, well, what do you do when people hurt you? You throw it right back, but you twist it. And mm-hmm. sometimes you throw it to others in your community and to friends, because mm-hmm. twisting it and playing with it helps. And it actually helps yeah. heal the wounds. So I think it's really important to portray them saying things like they do and mm-hmm. calling her a little straight girl and using mm-hmm. the term Agatha Christie, because my God, I mean, and I'm, you know, I'm a member of the gay community. I certainly know that there are ways that gay people of my acquaintance talk when they get together that others would interpret as offensive. And yeah, that's exactly the point. You know, that's yeah. why you do it. So if you didn't do it, I think it would harm the accuracy and the power of your portrayal of this community, and it wouldn't ring true. So you have to do it, but then you have to do it in a way that's not going to overwhelm the story or be hurtful to anyone reading the book. And I think you tread that line beautifully, because
thank you.
There are a lot of there are a lot of harmful words that you could use, and this book could be peppered with all sorts of slurs and horrible things, and it's not. And I never felt like I was being assaulted, or, you know, that I was uncomfortable with anything they said. It felt like you got it and I got it, and, you know, let's go along for the ride. And that's very much what happens when you write a book and then it's immediately published, and we're both existing within the same time. But I'm sure there's a really good chance that someone reading this book 50 years from now could have a similar experience to what we have when we read Agatha Christie, now that we're 100 mm-hmm. years out and counting, and think, oh my God, I can't believe that you use that word. So it's a little bit, it's the risk that you take, but mm-hmm. I do think it's a risk worth taking.
Mm. Thank you. That means the world. I'm so glad, because facing these slurs, having them hurled at us, yes, we can take them back, but some of them, they weren't mine to take back, and I'm not in that position.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't going to include them in that way. And sure, you know, if we hang out somewhere in the clubs, that's different. That's where yeah. we're using our own words with our own friends in that. But this is a book. This is going out to people anywhere and everywhere. And I wanted very much to make the point not to use. There's a scene later in the book where they're on the bridge And two people pass Maybe, and that's Robin in full drag. Mm-hmm. And May is beautiful and tall with a huge wig and a really massive dress. And it's really obviously fantastic. And these two people say a bad word. And I refer to the fact that they've said the word, but I don't say what the word is.
Yep.
And we all know what those words would be. And yeah. Each of us would have our own words. Not all of them are going to be the same. Well, the word that I hear might not be the same as the word you hear, but the pain is the same.
Absolutely.
The known pain of hearing those words over and over again, particularly when we're young, when we're vulnerable, when we're unsure of ourselves, that for me is as much part of my experience in the community as all the happy stuff. It's real.
No, I that moment stands out actually. And in some ways, I think it's more powerful even for not saying the word. It's forgive this analogy. I don't mean to offend by this analogy, but it's a little bit like how in Jaws, it's scarier when you don't see the shark.
Yeah,
because it's just always. What it's your own imagining, right? And then once you do see the shark, mm-hmm. it's a little bit deflating. But it's the same thing. We all, you know, we'll all have in our head, and especially for a reader, you know, who's a reader like me, who's coming from not the exact same community in a different community. And I'm American, mm-hmm. I'm not Irish, et cetera. You know, we're all different people, but it was very easy for me to supply the word that I've heard in mm-hmm. my life, and more powerful for me to supply it myself than just to read it on the page. So the delicacy with which you handle those moments, I just really appreciate it. And that's, I think, the only way to do a book like this. And it is very tricky and brave. So I applaud you for doing it. And I think one of the reasons I wanted to have you on and just talk about this book is that there aren't a lot of murder mysteries that are set within the LGBTQ mm-hmm. community. Still, that's not something that many people are doing. And part of it, I think, is because you do have to negotiate these sorts of issues, but it can be done. And you did it. And it's such a the vibrance of the community and your love for it. It really does shine through. So
thank you. We're fabulous, and we have just as much right to fictionally murder anybody else as anybody
exactly.
else.
Exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Bring it on. Yeah. I really wanted, particularly with things like pronouns and dealing with those sort of things, I wanted that to reflect real life and the real life around me. And there are people with different pronouns. So that should be part of it. The only problem is when you're writing is getting the he said, she said, and they said in the right place in the right way, so that when you're switching from, for instance, Robin to Maybe, who's the same mm-hmm. person, mm-hmm. but Robin would be he, him pronouns. May would be she, her pronouns. And when you're trying to do that, there's one bit when I do it in one paragraph, going from the beginning from Robin, then becoming Maybe. And that can get a little confusing. And for that, I rely on fantastic copy editors.
Yes, yes.
But
and you do, and I appreciate one of the queens within the community does, as a queen, go by male pronouns and has I guess it's a male persona, though it is a queen. Mm. He is a queen, not a king.
He is a male queen. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, just getting those nuances. And honestly, I hadn't thought about that until I read your book, where I was like, that makes perfect sense. But that nuance, I had never encountered it before. And that was really interesting to me. Well, you are obviously a huge Agatha Christie fan as well. That is very obvious when reading this book. And I wanted, of course, to talk to you about that. And I have to say, Kitty is an A++++ guest because no one has ever done this before. But before our interview yesterday, in fact, she wrote to me with her top five Agatha Christie novels. And I believe Hercule Poirot's Christmas was number one on that list.
Yeah, I didn't think you'd approve, but yeah. 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 And I should say I'm a massive fan, but I fail. I have a massive confession too. I don't like Tommy and Tuppence. I just don't. I can't get on with them.
Many people will be sort of applauding you right now. That is,
I feel like a failure in the world of Christie.
No, there are so many, I think, who fall into that camp. I did before I started the podcast. I think that the podcast just so enhanced my love for Christie that I literally will love and adore anything she writes at this point. It just doesn't even matter. I'm so starved for Christie. So perhaps that's why I have the affection that I do now for Tommy and Tuppence. Mm-hmm. But I felt the same when I was a slightly more casual reader. And they're not as good. I mean, I've said this before, but the best way of putting it, and I believe it was John Curran who said this, is that if you took just the Poirots, you know, she would still be one of the greatest detective fiction writers of the 20th century, easily, if not the greatest. The same even with the Marples, even though a lot of the gonzo high concepts are in the Poirots, but the Marples are so accomplished and, you know, a murder is announced, et cetera, et cetera. If she had just written the Tommy and Tuppences, would she be up there in the pantheon of the greatest writer? No, and I wouldn't even argue that. So I think that's fair. But please explain to me why Hercule Poirot's Christmas, which I have assiduously been bumping it up the rankings year after year. So I agree with you that there is a lot to love there. But I'm so curious. I want to hear why that is your favorite Agatha Christie.
I think it's partly because all the characters except Poirot are so awful. I mean, Simeon Lee is one of the worst, most horrible people. It's made such a big deal of, and nearly all of them for various reasons. They're terrible human beings. And it's done with so much fun. I think she aimed to write a really gory murder. There was, yes. When she was writing the book, she was, you know, and it's such, there's such relish. Yes. In the gore and the terribleness. And I believe it
was her brother-in-law. Her brother-in-law said, couldn't you do a nice bloody murder? Yeah. So she really went for it. Yeah.
And how wonderful is that? I just think it's fantastic.
Yeah. And obviously, as a concept, the twist, the blank did it. We don't have to spoil it in this episode, but the blank did it is brilliant and has echoes in other books that she wrote, in other plays and books that she wrote. But I agree with you. I think I might have to, I'm not going to do, I think, an official podcast reread of Hercule Poirot's Christmas like I just did with The Secret of Chimneys, because that was an exhausting endeavor. And I'm very glad I did it, but I might just have to read it for myself and see if this time I enjoy it a lot more than I did when Catherine and I read it, because we just were so down on it when we read. We really were.
I was yelling at you listening. I was like, no way. I mean, I read it sort of probably two or three times a year. It's one of my happy places.
Well, running down your list, because I want to talk about all the top five books here. We've got Hercule Poirot's Christmas, then Five Little Pigs, Preaching to the Choir, Murder on the Orient Express, Cards on the Table, and Crooked House. I think it's actually a great list. I think it's very, very defensible. I'm curious why you don't have And Then There Were None, because I think most people would probably put And Then There Were None somewhere in their top five. So what's your beef with And Then There Were None?
There isn't a beef, really. That'll probably be a joint number six with about 10 books crammed in there. But
right.
I think it's brilliant. I possibly overread it. It could be that. And I read it again last year and I thought, I knew what was coming every single time before it came. Yes. I wish I could go back and read it for the first time.
Yeah.
Because that would just be such a gift.
Yeah.
My only problem with my top five, and I wrestle with this now and then, is the lack of Hastings, because I love him. It's the characters for me. I mean, I love how you do the in the different ratings for the different aspects. But for me, my enjoyment is always the characters that I really, really love, whether I love to hate them or like on the Orient Express, just the outlandishness and the sparkle and the difference. And it's the characters.
What about Cards on the Table? I love that you have that in the top five. And there are many people that would absolutely include it in their top five, because it's one of those titles that you either really love or really don't, actually. Do you play bridge?
I tried it. I found it incredibly dull. This book is far from dull. I was like, what is the point? I don't get it. But it's, again, it's the layers with that, the plot layers, as well as the characters. And it could be anyone.
Yeah.
That's such a great thing.
I think one of the best things about Cards on the Table is the fact that there are only four suspects, because it's so audacious to only as a writer of a murder mystery, to only have four suspects in a full length novel is quite daunting. But what it means is that she can sink into those characters, and also that she has room, because not only are there four suspects, but then what she does is that she's allowed to have more investigative personalities, right? And that's where we have this super band, if you will, Ariadne Oliver and Colonel Race and Superintendent Battle and Hercule Poirot. That's such an embarrassment of riches as to the investigators. And she really can get, I think, granular about who all eight of those people are in that book and have fun with them. She has so much fun with all of those investigators and even the characters too. God, now that I'm thinking about it, I'm like, the cards on the table might need to be higher in our ranking.
it really should. Yeah.
It's a great one. There are just some people though that simply cannot with the Bridge thing. And in that, the solution does hinge a little bit on Bridge.
Yeah, on the schools. Rules. Yeah.
And that just doesn't bother me though, because I read it and I'm like, okay, that makes sense. I get it, even though I've literally never played a round of Bridge in my life and probably never will, because I don't think anyone would have patience with ever teaching it to me. But yeah, no, I love that you have that one in there as well.
I see that as more of a Poirot-ness than a Bridge-ness. It's more of the fact that he sees everything and that he thinks through everything than it is about specifically Bridge for me. And although that she only has the particular characters, apart from Mrs. Oliver and Poirot, you do feel at different points it could be anyone. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There are reasons, you know, and she leaves the reader to invent their own reasons to kind of go, oh, but what if it was them? No, what if it really was them? Because she's telling me it wasn't, so therefore it could be.
Yeah.
No one's safe.
It is funny because you have Crooked House here as your number five. And when I first read through this list, when you sent it to me yesterday, I was thinking, huh, this is not the list I would have predicted for the writer of Death and Heels. But now it actually makes sense because you were just identifying that what you love about Hercule Poirot's Christmas is how awful everyone is. And Crooked House, too. I mean, that is just maybe the most ghastly family that she ever created. They're gloriously ghastly. They're all just so awful in such different and entertaining ways. It's one of her most darkly funny books too, I think. Like that family is just, I could watch them or read about them forever. And you do something similar, I think. And this is why I think you're so good at depicting the drag community, because there is that darkness and there is that audacity and that kind of calling people out and being nasty, not because you're nasty, but because that's part of the culture and what you do and the way that you interact. And there's a lot, there can be and often is a lot of affection underneath it. There's also sometimes hatred underneath it as well, because these are all people. But I think the cast of characters that you created in Death and Heels has a little bit of that, like, oh, they're just so awful. And I love watching them and you know, witnessing their interactions and what are they going to say to each other next. So that makes a lot more sense to me now.
So I'm surprisingly evil in my tastes then. A Crooked House, for me, the ending is so fabulous, so well written, so well done.
Yes.
And again, we're not going into spoilers, but that as well, along with the horrifically awful characters, that was really important. A big ending. And that's for Heels. When I was looking at it, the ending of that was just as important for me. The big ending, the big, not in the same way, obviously, because Heels is silly and camp and murdery. But to have that big ending was really important.
Yes. And there is definitely a big ending.
There is.
There's a climax for sure. You know, and I am going to, for a second, spoil Crooked House, because I've had something about it I wanted to get off my chest for a while. So fast forward a couple of minutes if you haven't yet read Crooked House, listeners. But a number of people have actually contacted me recently, oddly, even though the Crooked House episode came out years ago, to make the point that at the end of Crooked House, when we have that scene where Josephine is being driven by her great aunt, I guess. I'm getting a little fuzzy on the details, but she's being driven in the car and the car goes over. It's not a cliff. They fall into a quarry.
It's a quarry,
right? Quarry, and they both die. I remember making this point when Catherine and I discussed the episode and then cutting it for time, because that was back when I still tried to make the episodes any, some sort of a reasonable length. I would always limit it to an hour. I was like, no one wants to listen to a podcast for more than an hour, but I have since obviously revised my opinion on that score.
Excellent.
But so many people have contacted me about this because it's something that I think when you're familiar with Agatha Christie's personal biography, you realize when you get to the end of that book, oh my God, when she disappeared, when she had her 11-day disappearance, she almost drove her car into a quarry.
Yeah.
And the fact that she did that in 1926, and then she's writing this book decades later, and that she had that grand finale take place in the way that she did, mm-hmm. that it just makes it that much more heartbreaking and moving, I think, in, yeah. in a book that has all of that cynicism and nastiness to it. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's actually a really affecting ending to, yeah. to that. And in a book that obviously involves a child murderer who is brought to justice by way of her death. You know, the fact that she's able to pull that off as she does is amazing, because she really does pull it off. But once you have that backstory as to Agatha Christie herself, I think it just enhances the read. So I'm annoyed that I cut that observation in the original episode. And I've wanted to mention now for a while, having heard from just one or two people in the last couple of weeks, though, it's just by coincidence, I was like, I need to share that with everyone, because it really is, I think, an important point when it comes to Crooked House.
It is. And I only got that from your mention of the autobiography, which meant that I ordered the autobiography and I was reading it and I sat up and I suddenly realized, and I could picture that scene so strongly from reading the book, and thought, that's so, it's so poignant. It suddenly goes from being this big, murdery, crimey, quite outlandish book to something that's really quite heartfelt and sad, and you know, that none of us obviously know what was happening for her in her head, because no one can know what's happening with someone in their own head. But just seeing how she reused that in that way, I thought was a really, really emotional thing.
Absolutely. Well, back to you in your stories. So I'm assuming that did you write the first and second book at the same time? I mean, how did you manage to have the first book come out in January and the second book in April? That is insane. Kitty.
Well, it was lockdown. I wasn't doing anything else. And I missed my friends and I missed going out. So I created my own little world. I wrote the first one. And then while the first one was out with my agent and then going out to publishers, I just kept going. So I wrote the second one. So I was ready with it. Then originally we were going to publish the first one last year. We moved the date back. So there's a slightly smaller gap between.
Why was the date moved back?
We were looking at different publicity available to us if we moved the date. It was a simple publishing sort of a thing. Okay. So it got moved then. So it's a smaller gap, and there'll be a bigger gap before 3, 4, and 5, I think. And we'll see how that goes. But I think it's one of my many failings. I just can't shut up. I just want to be with these characters. I wake up in the morning and think, what would Miss Merkin be doing? And I'm wandering down the street in Dublin, and I'm seeing Thora Point stepping out of a taxi in my mind, and you know, they're in my head. So
have you written the third one already?
I have written the third one, but we haven't gone through editing, so we'll see how it goes.
Okay.
I have the most incredible editor, Russell McLean, who I give him something I think is amazing, and he turns around and goes, yeah, but there's this, isn't there? And I think, oh, yeah, there is.
Are they all going to be fairly traditional puzzle mysteries as well? Is the format going to remain the same?
Fairly traditional, but looking at different aspects. Number two, I bring in drag kings. It's really important to me to show more of the community. So we meet Stan the Man, and we meet a few of the other drag kings who I really love writing. And I think 3 and 4, particularly 4, I want to look at a closed house, you know, a big old murder mystery hotel-y kind of house. Mm-hmm. I really want to get into that one. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I have different ideas, but they'll all be nods to that world. I grew up reading those books. I love them. I read them all the time. So it's in my blood. It's, you know, the same for all of us, isn't it, when we love these books?
Yes. Oh, it's a part of who you are.
Yeah.
Well, you know that I wasn't going to let you go without forcing you to answer the podcast's age-old question for interviewees: Poirot or Marple?
Poirot. I think Poirot always.
Why?
That's the difficulty, isn't it? Because as soon as I start looking at Marple, I think, yeah, but there are these points too. Because Marple seems to get other people to do the investigation as much, really. She's happy to sit back and, you know, the knitting and the gardening and the this and the that. And she sees things and she sees the picture, but she gets the other people to do the work. Poirot gets in there and he figures things out in a way that I wish I could. He has this wonderful brain. Crime is very real. We write these mysteries and we love them, but it's there in real life. The attacks, the homophobic, transphobic attacks in Dublin have gone up again recently. The poison is there. And how wonderful to picture someone like Poirot figuring it out and making sure that the bad folks get their comeuppance, that the good folks will be okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I made this point actually in the first episode that I did after the passing of Catherine Brobeck, my former partner, of course. And in the wake of losing her, I remember editing the episode that we had recorded just before she passed. So I had to edit that episode after she had passed away. And as we do, as we did on so many episodes, we're being jokey about people getting murdered and death. And at first I was cringing and wincing and I was like, oh my God, I can't believe that we spent all this time sort of delighting in something that's very real and very painful that I'm now experiencing in such a different way. But almost immediately I said, well, no, that's rubbish because that's the point. I mean, part of the point is that life is always going to be painful. There's an extra layer to it for the drag community or the LGBTQ community, especially now. And that reality is there. And what you do when you're writing a murder mystery and, you know, you're creating a puzzle that people can then solve is that you're doing something enjoyable and you're doing something that can be a vent and let off steam and in some ways, hopefully help people deal with what's actually happening in their lives, right? I mean, that's why. And you're doing it with, in some ways, the very thing that they're struggling with. You're doing it with death and loss and the real pain that comes from violence. That's what you're actually writing about. And it makes it that much more powerful, I think. It can be jarring when you have an experience like I did, where, you know, you actually lose someone in the midst of having, you know, delighted about the fictional versions of death and loss, but that's okay. And it's one of the reasons we do it. I never want to fall into the trap of saying, and that's why we read murder mysteries, because murder mysteries are catharsis and that's it. It's like, no, there's a lot of reasons why people read literature, and murder mysteries are literature and it's complicated. So we don't need to be reductive about it. But I think that's particularly one of the reasons why so many people do enjoy murder mysteries as much as they do. And it's one of the reasons that they're so important.
Yeah, I totally agree.
I've almost never been convinced when a guest has said that they prefer Poirot to Marple. And I'm still not, because Miss Marple is better. She just is. But I like the idea, though, that Poirot is an active investigator. Like, he's someone who would you actually want, you know, in real life? You probably would want Poirot, because Miss Marple, you know, she really does. Her investigatory prowess is all as to intuition. It's all as to insight into human nature and intuition. And Poirot, of course, has the same insight into human nature. But he does actually, for all his protestations that he's an armchair detective, he gets down in it and he actually investigates. He's so inconsistent about that. And Christie is inconsistent about that. But Miss Marple is the true armchair detective, except when she's like hiding in broom closets and, you know, stuff like that.
But leaping out,
she has her moments too. She's got her act, or like running upstairs and not, you know, often at the very end of a book, she gets quite active in very unrealistic ways. But yeah, that answer works for me. Well,
great.
This has been absolutely lovely, Kitty. I really so enjoyed Death in Heels, and I can't wait to revisit the drag community at Trash, which, for the record too, Trash is not a real place.
No, it's okay. Very much not real. It's very much fictional. Yeah.
Well, maybe one day I can come to Dublin and we could take in a show or something one of the very real places.
I'll hold you to that. Yeah.
That would be really, really fun. And best of luck on book number two as it rolls out. And I think, you know, your book can be purchased either in a bookstore. And if you're going to go to a bookstore, please try to go to an independent bookstore. These days, they're struggling as much as they ever have been, or as an ebook. The first one is out and the second one will be out within a number of weeks. So I hope that, you know, more people discover this world and that you can write as many books within it as you would wish to.
Thank you. Thank you so much for this. It's been wonderful.
Thanks so much. Thank you again to Kitty Murphy for sitting down with me. What a lovely conversation we had. Again, Kitty's first book, Death in Heels, is out now. Her second book, Death in the Dark, will be out in just over 2 weeks on April 11th of this year. For my next episode, I will be covering 4 and 20 Blackbirds, the final Hercule Poirot short story to be covered on this podcast. It is with a bit of a heavy heart that I have to admit it is finally happening. We have our last Poirot waiting in the wings. We still have a Marple. After that, there's one more Miss Marple short story. So all is not lost. Deep breaths, deep breaths. I will, of course, be covering the David Suchet adaptation as well when I cover that short story. If you would like more content, you can always go visit the podcast's Patreon page at www.patreon.com/allaboutagatha. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. Or just click the link in the notes to this episode. I just reviewed the indie film Bodies, Bodies, Bodies in March. And in April, I will be covering The Wintringham Mystery by Golden Age author Anthony Barclay Cox. Very excited for that. You can always email me at allaboutthedame@gmail.com. You can find the podcast on Twitter at allaboutthedame and on Instagram at allaboutagatha. And I would really appreciate it if you would give the podcast a rating and or a review. I've gotten a couple of really nice ones recently, and it warms my heart whenever I see one coming in, even if it's not a good one. Not that I'm telling you to send me a mean review. Please don't. But I will take an honest, constructive review any day. A review is always a good thing. Or just a rating without a review. That's fine too. All right. See you next time. Bye.